Breadbox Media Programming is brought to you by Jack Kane Ford. Find your next Ford Tough vehicle at caneford.com. Woodhill Community Center. Have a hand in the heart of the city. Support their mission with your donations at woodhillcommunitycenter.org. Toyota in Nicholasville Superstore. Online consultants are standing by right now to help you find your next Toyota. Visit Toyota on Nicholasville.com. Lexus of Lexington, home of the best-selling Lexus IS. Find yours today at LexusofLexington.com. Introducing the redesigned CatholicSingles.com, featuring new ways that put the spotlight on the person and their faith, not just a profile picture. For the past 20 years, faithful Catholics have used CatholicSingles.com, and the reimagined CatholicSingles.com website is ready to help single Catholics take the next step in sharing meaningful relationships with other faithful Catholics. Remember, CatholicSingles.com for faith, fellowship, and love.
Welcome to Misfit Faith, where anything worth doing is worth doing badly. Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to episode number 31 of the Misfit Faith podcast. I am Jason Stelman, your host. Our phone number is 949-354-2483, or Y Eli Byte. That's the handy phrase that my phone number spells. I didn't ask for that. That's just what they gave me. So it helps me remember the number. Anyway, welcome to the show. We're continuing our series called Vaticant, or Catholicism Without All the Uplifting Parts. Before we jump in, though, just to remind you, patreon.com/Jason Stelman is where you can go to find out more about supporting the work that I do. There are various tiers that you can join, $1 a month, $5 a month, $10 a month. Each of them has rewards associated with them. And so if you wouldn't mind visiting my Patreon page, then that would be great. My website is jasonstelman.com, and that is where you can find my blog posts. You can find this podcast there. You can find out a little bit more about me. You can shop there for various items, such as the Misfit Faith audiobook. The deluxe version is for sale on the website, and the Misfit Faith video course is also for sale there. And there's also a tab you'll notice that's called Speaking. As you may know, I used to be a pastor, and I basically spent from age, 18 until just a few years ago doing a lot of public speaking on a weekly basis. And to be honest, that's probably the one thing about the ministry that I miss the most is speaking. And so if you are a part of a church, if you've got a group, if you're organizing an event, a conference, whatever it might be, and if you're looking for a speaker, and if you're interested in some of the themes that I talk about, then click there, fill out the contact form, and I will be notified. I'd love to come and speak to your group, at your event, whatever it is that you may need. You just provide me a ticket and a topic, and I will hop on a plane and be there. All right, enough of that. Let's go. Now, as I mentioned, we began a series a few weeks ago here on the Misfit Faith podcast called Vaticant, and it is sort of an exploration of how my own Catholicism, or as I sometimes put it, my Catholicism, is informed by some of the ideas from writers and thinkers that I've been interacting with and engaging with over the past several years. Ideas like divine nonviolence, radical theology, religionless Christianity from Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And this week, we're going to be introducing a somewhat surprising, unlikely topic of inspiration, and that is quantum theory. Now, in my last couple of posts, I've discussed the lack or the void that is intrinsic to our own human experience. And as I've suggested, the way that we often deal with this sense of emptiness is to insist that it is an unnatural intruder. It's something that needs to be overcome. It's something that didn't used to be there. It was introduced at a certain point, and the goal is to get rid of this lack, to get around this sense of emptiness, to avoid the void. And this happens on a secular level, of course, and it certainly happens on a religious level. And when it happens on a religious level, the Christian solution to this problem is to say that this void, it can't be filled by the pleasures of this world, right? And so you can't look to sex to fill the emptiness, to drugs, to alcohol, to a relationship, to money, to power, to fame. No, none of these things are going to work to fill your emptiness. So the story goes, only Jesus can. He is the one who can fill your emptiness. He's the one who can bestow genuine wholeness and completeness upon us. Well, last week I suggested that, you know, perhaps this entire approach is mistaken. And the underlying assumption that's doing all the heavy lifting here, namely that, you know, we aren't supposed to feel this lack, maybe that underlying assumption is incorrect. And the way I put it was that maybe our mistake is not that we're trying to heal ourselves with all the wrong remedies, but that we're trying to heal ourselves at all. Well, this is where quantum theory comes in. Now, I am not a scientist. I am not a scientifically minded person. I'm not a scientifically inclined person, like, at all. But I do know a little bit about this as I'm reading a book by Diarmuid O'Muircheartú, whom I will be interviewing in just a moment, if I can get him on the phone. But I'm reading his book, Quantum Theology, and as little as I do know about this, I know this much. To appreciate how revolutionary quantum physics is, as it was sort of discovered and became more and more mainstream in the early part of the 20th century, we have to first know a thing or two about classical physics, about the old model, about Newtonian physics. Now, one of the primary assumptions of the old model, and this is not just an old thing, this is still the operating assumption for many scientists. If you're at all familiar with kind of popular scientists like Neil deGrasse Tyson, Bill Nye, these various kind of pop scientists, many of them seem to still assume this, which is a cardinal assumption of classical physics, and that is this, that the universe is explicable. The universe is understandable, at least in theory. Now, it's true that we don't know everything yet, and there are all kinds of things that we still are trying to figure out, but that's only because we haven't had the time yet, or perhaps the technology, to learn these things, to solve these puzzles. But in principle, the world is understandable. The universe is explicable. Everything can be understood. It just hasn't yet. But since the whole is just equal to the sum of its constituent parts, it's only a matter of time, and perhaps of tech, until we will have broken everything down, until we will have pulled everything apart and found the building blocks of all things and examined all of them and come to an understanding of all of life's so-called mysteries. Okay, that's the sort of operating assumption of classical physics, and I would suggest perhaps of most scientifically inclined people, scientists included. But it's here that quantum theory comes in with a big old nope. You see, the discoveries of quantum physicists have led them to insist that no, the universe is not in principle explainable. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and reality is, well, mysterious. Now, let me give you an illustration to explain the difference. Now, I don't know about you, but back in the good old days, I was a fan of the TV show The X-Files. And if you've seen the TV show The X-Files, you know that it's about a couple of FBI agents whose job it is to try to solve cases involving paranormal activity, often involving aliens, okay? And in the office of this main agent, his name is Mulder, played by David Duchovny, on the wall of his office, which is located in like the basement of the FBI building in Washington because no one respects the work that he does, on the wall is a poster, and it's one of those famous kind of blurry photographs of a flying saucer-looking thing, a UFO, and written on the poster are the words, "I want to believe," okay? Now, you've probably seen this exact photograph before. You've probably, you know, seen other purported images, photos of flying saucers, of UFOs that you may have seen on the internet or wherever. And if you're a skeptic, then the first question that you're going to ask is this. Why are all these pics so blurry? You know, I mean, if the flying saucer, like, hovered over your barn... And of course, I'm assuming the person who saw the UFO has a barn. If it hovered over your barn for 10 minutes, like, why couldn't you capture it with a more sharper image? You know, why couldn't you get a sharper, a more focused photo of this flying saucer that was just hovering there? But you see, consider this. What if the flying saucers are themselves blurry? In other words, what if we're not looking at a blurry picture of a sharp object, but what if we're looking at a perfectly good picture of an inherently blurry object? Right? It's the same with like Bigfoot. You know, all the photos of Bigfoot are always blurry. Well, what if Bigfoot's blurry? Like, what if you saw him in real life and he just was blurry, right? What if the flying saucers themselves are blurry? Well, quantum theory insists that the universe, as it were, is blurry. There is mystery. There is an unknowability baked into the very bones of the world. And so therefore, any attempt to overcome our unknowing is always folly. Any attempt to sort of break everything down and understand it is always folly and often arrogance and usually patriarchal as well. Because the scientist is assuming that the physical world is the object and he is the subject. And he is standing over in a kind of posture of arrogance and control and mastery and dominion, looking through his telescope, looking through his microscope, seeking to examine and understand and wrap his head around everything. And so this sense that we have, therefore, you know, that something just doesn't add up. You know, I described it in a recent episode by appealing to Neo from The Matrix, Thomas Anderson, played by Keanu Reeves, who is a computer hacker by night, but he works in some firm, some accounting firm or something by day. But his entire existence is plagued by this nagging question, what is The Matrix? He doesn't know what The Matrix is. He doesn't even know why he's asking the question, but he just knows that this question is haunting him and he needs to find an answer. Well, this sense that we have, that, you know, that something is amiss, that something's out of place, that something doesn't add up, there's a void, there's a lack at our very core. This sense is not only correct, according to quantum theory, but it also reflects the way things are and must be. You know, simply put, we cannot avoid the void because it's hardwired into the very nature of reality itself. Now, as I said, I'm reading Dermot Omurcu's book, Quantum Theology, and I'm going to be hopefully chatting with him in just a moment if I can get him on the phone, but I do want to quote a portion from his book. He says this. He says, and the reason he calls it quantum theology is because he's applying the findings of physicists and the ramifications of those findings to spirituality, okay? And here's what he says. He says, quantum theology seeks to befriend the pain and embrace the dark. It seeks to redeem the chaos, but not by projecting it onto a divine scapegoat. In embracing the chaos, all humans are invited to recognize the interdependent nature of light and darkness, sickness and health, death and rebirth. By learning to befriend the chaos of our world, we interact with and integrate our personal chaos or sinfulness in more authentic ways. Instead of seeking to escape from our pain by the addictive behaviors of denial and scapegoating, We begin to engage with it, listen to it, and learn from it. And then finally, he says this, redemption is about reclaiming the darkness, the nothingness, the void, and the chaos of our world and celebrating the negative potential for new life and wholeness. A truly honest Christianity, a truly authentic Catholicism, therefore, will be infused with a profound realism and humility concerning just how abundant the abundant life can actually be, insisting that the chaos and the absurdity at the heart of existence and at the very core of ourselves cannot be circumnavigated. The task then, indeed, the very gospel, involves embracing the dark rather than denying it, bearing our crosses to the death with an eye to a this worldly resurrection, whatever that may look like. As I said, my guest is going to be Diarmaid O'Murcu. He is a social psychologist. He's a priest. He's a member of the Sacred Heart Ministry congregation. He lives in London. And he's written several books, but as I said, the one that I have been reading, which I would heartily recommend to all of you, is called Quantum Theology, Spiritual Implications of the New Physics. Let me see if I can get Diarmaid on the phone here just a moment.
Hello.
Hi, I'm looking for Diarmaid O'Murcu. Is he available?
Yes, this is Diarmaid O'Murcu. Thank you.
Oh, man, I said your last name wrong, didn't I?
O'Murcu. Yeah, that'll pass.
O'Murcu.
Yeah.
Well, Diarmaid, I've shared with my audience already that I'm making my way through your book, Quantum Theology, and I'm finding it incredibly fascinating. And, you know, I don't have a science background. My audience, most of them don't have a science background. So I was wondering if, you know, in layman's terms, you could tell us the difference between classical and quantum physics, and then sort of briefly outline how this is relevant for theology.
Okay. Well, it's rather simple in one sense. Classical science is very concerned about the precise, objective nature of everything in the universe. Or to put it in very simple terms, that everything is a thing that can be objectified, that can be managed, that can be measured, and so forth. Whereas, and therefore, it talks about particles, it talks about atoms and subatomic particles. Quantum physics, on the other hand, the fundamental idea is that everything is a relationship based on energy. And that energy is not a case, to use the traditional imagery, of billiard balls bouncing off each other, which is more the classical understanding, that in quantum physics, the energy is always seeking deeper, better ways of connecting and of interconnecting. And so they talk about the wave particle. Then according to the theory, which we're dealing with depends on how we kind of evoke that particular reality. But to keep it simple, yeah, one is about objects in their isolated or discrete conditions and how they bounce off each other. And quantum physics is fundamentally about how things relate and how things interconnect. So quantum physics claims that everything in our universe is fundamentally programmed for relationship. Now, keep that in mind. That's already a fundamental principle of theology in the doctrine of the Trinity. Whatever else that doctrine is trying to state, it is an attempt at articulating that whatever else our understanding of God is about, it's about relationship. However, there is another way of approaching the God question, which is then leading us more deeply into theology. If you begin to ask the question, which science doesn't want to ask and theology is reluctant to ask, what energizes the energy that makes up everything in creation? One of the answers is living spirit, or the power of living spirit. In Christian theology, we call that Holy Spirit. But as I explain in one of my books, In the Beginning Was the Spirit, our indigenous peoples around the world talk about the concept of the Great Spirit. And in many ways, that's much closer to the understanding of God that emerges from quantum physics. That this notion of God as pure spirit, energizing the energy that gives basis and foundation to everything else, is one way of approaching the God question from within quantum physics. So you have quantum physics, which is fundamentally about energy relating with energy, and at the heart or core of that relating is that power of spirit, which in Christian theology we call Holy Spirit, or if you want to approach it another theological way, which is a bit more complicated, then you can bring in the doctrine of the Trinity. But understanding that doctrine in relational terms, as distinct from the metaphysical terms, which Christian theology adopted in early Christian times and still holds on to today in the more formal teaching of theology.
It's interesting, too, to think that, you know, often the Holy Spirit is depicted or spoken of in female and sort of female gender terms, because what you're describing as far as the classical approach, sounds, and you even make the point in your book, it sounds rather masculine, you know, that we are sort of standing over nature and torturing it until it gives up its secrets. It's very much rooted, it seems, in that patriarchal sort of dominion style theology.
Mm-hmm. Yep, that's true. Yes. And it's interesting, even the kind of metaphors we use to describe the Holy Spirit. The most frequent one is wind. We also use fire. The ruah, or the ruach in the Hebrew, means breath, the living vibration. Once you begin to bring in the notion of vibration, you're touching on the whole concept of energy. So you have energy manifested through vibration, made more explicit in wind or fire. All the metaphors kind of blend in or can be integrated more readily with this understanding, with this scientific background, and then the new understanding of theology will emerge from it.
One of the things I've been talking about on this show the last couple of weeks is the fact that we humans sort of intuitively sense a lack or a void or some sort of mysterious question mark at the very heart of existence itself. And much of contemporary theology is designed to help us get around that and avoid confronting that lack. But I'm curious, what might the quantum approach have to say about this lack or this mystery or this big question mark that we feel at the heart of ourselves and at the heart of existence itself?
I think there are two concepts arising from within quantum physics. One is this notion of the creative vacuum, that it's out of empty space that everything eventually emerges. Therefore, the emptiness is in fact a fullness. It's a fullness of potential creative energy, which of course is an insight that many of the great mystics have articulated over time. The second concept, a more difficult one to explain to people, is the notion of paradox. And again, I recall a book by a guy called Cyprian Smith many years ago, and he was writing about British mystics going back in the Middle Ages. And the title he used for the book, The Way of Paradox. Now, the paradox we're talking about here, which is articulated well in contemporary cosmology, is this interaction of creation and destruction, and that we need both for a creative universe. On the surface, that sounds like a contradiction. But I think the word paradox is much more appropriate, as indeed used and cited by St. Paul. When Paul says, when I'm weak, then I'm strong. In ordinary conversation or in standard language, that sounds like a contradiction. But as Paul is using it, it's actually the language of paradox. And many of us at various stages in our lives have been there. So we have a sense of what he's talking about. Now, my definition of paradox, it's a contradiction, but with meaning written underneath. And that statement is very much in keeping with the spirit of quantum physics. Whereas in classical physics, one needs to be able to explain everything rationally and logically. When we come to quantum physics, we are dealing with a methodology and we're dealing with a way of seeing things that's bigger than rationality. The parables of the New Testament would be another good example. They're full of that kind of paradox. And so the wisdom we're dealing with is a more expanded, extended wisdom that transcends, that rises above, that goes beyond mere rationality or the rational, logical way of understanding life.
Isn't it true that in classical physics, if something is not explained, it's simply because we've yet to explain it, but in principle, everything is explicable. Whereas in the quantum vision or the quantum worldview, the universe is not in principle explainable or understandable, but instead there are mysteries that are just kind of hardwired into the very nature of the universe itself, right?
That's quite a good way of putting it, indeed. And one of the dangers in classical science, I've just been reading recently a book on quantum biology, which is trying to apply some of the principles of quantum theory to biology. And the authors very rightly make the point, which struck me several years ago. You know, when it comes to something like the DNA within our bodies or within organic life generally, we only understand about 10% of it. Just indeed, as the matter in the universe, we only understand about 10% of it. 90% is just dark matter, and we haven't made any sense of yet. But the biologists, who traditionally have tended to be a bit more open than your classical physicists, yet despite the fact that they have been that bit more open, the 90% that they have not been able to understand or use, they have for long dismissed it as junk DNA. Junk DNA. And basically what these authors that I'm reading at the moment are saying, in all probability, there's no such thing as junk DNA. It's just that 90% of it, we haven't figured out yet what it's about. And we're going to need something bigger than the classical rationalistic approach to figure out what that 90% is about.
That seems like such a hubristic way or approach that, you know, if 90% of the DNA is mysterious to us, then it just doesn't matter. It's junk. As opposed to seems like the quantum, you know, approach is much more humble in that it recognizes that, no, it's not junk. We've just yet to really wrap our minds around it.
That is correct. And that's one of the sad things, even though I have huge admiration for a lot of scientists, and I certainly am open to learning from them all. But I have found it difficult at times to have conversations with some of those scientists that I did want to learn from, because they can be extremely arrogant. They can be extremely patriarchal. And now, mind you, I have to say I have met theologians who are the same way, you know, particularly coming maybe more from a more fundamentalist approach and a very dogmatic, almost closed way of understanding concepts like revelation, for example. And the whole idea of seeing the wonders and the mystery and the beauty and the love of God manifested in and through nature is still something that a lot of theologians feel very apprehensive about. And so, yes, there is a dogmatism in the upbringing that many of us have been given, whether from the scientific side or the theological side. And I like your word. Yeah, if we could be much more humble, open, receptive about it. That's why I love that definition of prayer from Paul's letter to the Romans. It's not we who pray, it's the Spirit of God who prays in us. If we're not open and receptive to that prayerfulness of the Spirit, then, you know, we're in danger of missing a huge amount of that mystery, which is the heart and core of our reality, really.
That sort of brings me to my next question, which you touched upon already, but I was wondering if you could explain for us the difference between, you know, moving from physics to theology, classical theology's notion of God as this external agent. You know, he's outside of us, up there, out there somewhere. Whereas in your book, you describe quantum theology's understanding of God as sort of more intrinsic to the universe. In other words, working from within the created order rather than working upon it from without. Could you talk a bit about that?
Yes, sure. Well, of course, the kind of traditional inherited imagery of God, whether we draw on this idea of the prime mover, which is at the heart of the more Catholic approach, but it's there in all the Christian approaches. Now, the prime mover can often carry rather mechanistic connotations. of, you know, in a sense, similar to Isaac Newton, who did believe in God. But for him, God was the great clock winder. And it's unclear from Newton's work whether God is continuously winding the clock or wound it once, and then the universe goes on from there in clock-like fashion. And of course, that then leads also to the whole notion of an interventionist God, that despite the fact that this God seems to have been the perfect creator, somehow or other he didn't get it right, and then we had to bring in the whole intervention of God through Jesus and the plan of salvation and so on and so forth. Whereas, yes, in quantum physics, which to this extent is very close then to mysticism, although mysticism is a vastly complex kind of field of study. Not all theorists in mysticism would necessarily agree with this. But there is the sense of the God from within, and that is the withinness of God that matters. And that has nothing at all to do with pantheism or anything like that, because we're not saying that God is confined to creation, but that somehow God's loving participation, care, concern for the creation is in and with the evolving nature of that creation itself. Again, this is where I'm very much attracted to the notion of the Great Spirit in the indigenous faith systems around the world, because for our First Nations peoples, they don't worship God, they don't pray to God. They basically use their rituals and their ceremonies in order to collaborate more creatively with the God whose presence, whose love, whose empowerment is mediated primarily through the creation. Another way of approaching this would be there's a Canadian theologian, she's now quite an old woman, called Sally McFaig, and she has been talking for several years about creation as God's embodiment, and that God is primarily embodied in how God reveals God's self to us in and through the creation, and that God works primarily in and through bodies, or in her language, God loves bodies. And you may recall that part in the Gospels, I don't have the exact reference, where there's an evil spirit cast out of somebody, and the spirit goes around roaming, trying to find something else to inhabit. The point seems to be that spirit can do little or nothing without being embodied. And so it's an interesting way when you bring the two notions together, because in traditional theology, they tend to be kept more apart. They tend to be dualistically opposed. That if you're really into the stuff of body, then you can't be into spirit, because somehow spirit is opposite body. Whereas in this approach, which I think is grounded very much in the vision of quantum physics, spirit is mediated, spirit flourishes, spirit thrives in and through body, and the greatest body and the primary body of God that we know is the universe.
Yeah, I find it ironic that in contemporary evangelicalism, at least, there's such, as you mentioned, a kind of hostile posture toward the physical world, as though physical things are some sort of threat to our spirituality, when at the same time, the central tenet supposedly of evangelical Christianity is the incarnation of the Son of God, that God actually assumed human nature and assumed a human body together with his divine nature. And I've always just found it very, very sort of ironic that we can, on the one hand, celebrate Christmas and fight against this war on Christmas every December, when we, speaking broadly as the evangelical church, we are waging a war on Christmas every time we write a theology book, because we sort of argue for this hostile stance toward the physical world.
Right. Correct. Absolutely. And that's why a lot of the people looking at particularly this field of study called the new cosmology, or the new story, as they call it in the United States, an amazing number of people that have taken on that study with a broad kind of scientific base to it, do find themselves attracted to quantum physics on the one hand, and to the story of the great mystics on the other. There's a potential there for an integration rather than this dualistic splitting, which I think has done a horrendous damage to many of us in the various Christian denominations.
Yeah, I agree. I think you know, our knee-jerk response always should be toward integration and unification rather than, you know, in my own background growing up in evangelicalism, it was always toward who can we divide against next? Who can we sort of scapegoat and label as our enemy next and define ourselves over against in order to sort of legitimize ourselves? So I really like this entire posture that you're describing. I was wondering, as kind of last question, what you talk in the book about the classical approach to science sees the universe as an object of study, and we are the subjects. And so we stand, as it were, as kind of masters over the universe, which we can look at either in a microscope or through a telescope. And you say that instead a quantum approach would say that the universe is a subject and that we belong to it. And I was wondering if you could kind of flesh that out and talk a bit more about that distinction.
Yeah, let me begin by giving a very simple example. This is based on an interesting piece of study done in one of these, I suppose they'd be described as New Age communities, way back in the 1970s in Scotland. But in fact, I think it has since been verified scientifically. They experimented a lot with using music to help plants to grow and to help vegetables to grow. And one of the things they discovered is, and this has now been verified scientifically to the best of my knowledge, if you take a head of lettuce out of the ground and consume it within 1 hour, you get something like 95% of its natural nutrients. If you like, God's gift of life through the vegetation, through the vegetable in this case. So 95% of its nutrients, if you eat it within 1 hour, having taken it from the ground. If you eat it 4 hours later, you only get 60% of its natural God-given nutrients. In other words, the classical science will look at the head of lettuce as an object and its potential to nourish. They will look at it through various chemical dimensions that they will explain in more mechanistic terms. Whereas if we look at the head of lettuce as a living organism, and we are living organisms, and how the living energy of one connects with the other, and that there is a right time to consume the head of lettuce for our nourishment, then, of course, we also have to think about how do we give it back, or how do we give life back to the wider universe. There you begin to see this foundational principle of quantum physics, that everything should be thought about in terms of how energy relates with energy, rather than looking at things as objects that are there for our use and benefit. The other quick example, because I think it's examples that speak here more powerfully than all the theory on earth. I'm told that in terms of contemporary medicine, something like 50% of the medicines we use every day for a range of illnesses are taken from the byproducts of a range of trees in the Amazonian forests, parts of which are being stripped away at a deadly rate. In other words, if you like, the universe is waiting to heal us if we could be only open and receptive to receive that healing. But as long as we keep looking at the trees as objects that are there to be cut down, the forests are there to be decimated to make wood for buildings or whatever it might be, and I don't deny that we do need wood for buildings, but if we look at everything as mere physical objects to be used, then we're missing the whole deeper meaning, and a meaning that has such enormous significance for our own meaning as human spiritual beings.
That is all so fascinating. I would remind the audience, the book of yours that I'm reading, which is, I just realized, is over 20 years old now, Quantum Theology. But Dharmit, I'm wondering if you could maybe let our audience know, are there new projects that you're working on? I don't know if you're active on social media, but where can my listeners engage your work more if they choose to learn more about what you're talking about? Do you have a website? What are some of your most recent projects?
I think the best way, because I live in Europe and I'm not great on the social media front, I do have a webpage, www.dharmuid, my first name, dearmouth13.com, dearmouth13.com. And I probably will, now that I'm in my older years and I'm traveling less, I do hope to put on some more essays and stuff on there. But it's my books that are still the primary way of accessing my material. I think anybody that's interested in the God concept of quantum physics won't go far wrong in having a read at one of my more recent books called In the Beginning Was the Spirit. In the beginning was the spirit. And then my last book, which has also come out from the same publisher, Orbis in New York, is called Incarnation, and the subtitle, A New Evolutionary Threshold. So I bring in concepts of evolution in there too, which is a bit of a hot potato, and certainly for a lot of evangelical folks still in the United States. So those would be two of the books of mine that would be very valuable. There is another book, I have it right here in front of me, that I would like to draw your readership attention to, because it is such a fascinating read. And it, you know, for people that know absolutely nothing about quantum physics, I think they will be enthralled if they're coming from a kind of a spiritual background. The author is Miriam Trace Winter, W-I-N-T-E-R, Miriam Trace, T-H-E-R-E-S-E. And the book has a wonderful title on it, Paradoxology. 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 And the subtitle is Spirituality in a Quantum Universe. It was published in 2009. I recommend it to everybody who's beginning trying to get in a bit deeper into this field. It's a most inspiring read, and I have no hesitation in saying that.
I'll certainly be adding that to my list, because I find this entire topic so fascinating. But Dearmouth, thank you so much. I know it's you're 9 hours ahead of me on the West Coast. You're over there in the UK. And so I thank you for taking some time at the end of your day to chat with us.
You're very welcome indeed. I've enjoyed chatting with you.
Throughout his book, Quantum Theology, Omerku lists 12 principles, what he calls principles of quantum theology, and they're sort of interspersed throughout the book, and then they're included in an appendix all together. I searched for these everywhere on the internet to try to avoid having to type them all out myself, but I couldn't find them anywhere, so I did go ahead and type them out. They are available on my website, jasonstellman.com/blog, my most recent entry, but I also wanted to just go ahead and read them to you as we finish the show. And so these are the 12 principles of quantum theology. This is what happens when you apply the findings of the new physics to spirituality. Principle number one, life is sustained by a creative energy, fundamentally benign in nature, with a tendency to manifest and express itself in movement, rhythm, and pattern. Creation is sustained by a superhuman pulsating restlessness, a type of resonance vibrating through time and eternity. Principle number two, wholeness, which is largely unmanifest and dynamic, not static, is the wellspring of all possibility. In seeking to understand life, we begin with the whole, which is always greater than the sum of the parts. Paradoxically, the whole is contained in each part, yet no whole is complete in itself. Principle number three, evolution is underpinned by a deep unfolding structure characterized by design and purpose, necessitating an unceasing interplay of order and disorder, randomness and creativity. Principle number four, the expanding horizon of divine belonging is the context in which revelation takes place. All creatures are invited to respond, to engage in the co-creative task of being and becoming. All life forms have unique roles in this process, the primary focus of which is creation itself rather than formal religion. Principle number five. Because the capacity to relate is itself the primary divine energy impregnating creation, we humans need authentic ecclesial and sacramental experiences to explore and articulate our innate vocation to be people in relationship. Principle number six, ultimate meaning is embedded in story, not in facts. All particular religious stories belong to a larger story, which includes but also transcends the specific religious traditions of any one historical or cultural epoch. All sacred texts are attempts at articulating ultimate truth and archetypal values, approximations that require fresh interpretation in each new cultural epoch. Principle number 7, and this is the one I referred to a moment ago in my remarks. Redemption is planetary and cosmic, as well as personal. Redemption is about reclaiming the darkness, the nothingness, the void, and the chaos of our world, and celebrating the negative potential for new life and wholeness. Principle number 8. Structural and systemic sin abound in our world, often provoking people to behave immorally. To integrate the global shadow, we need fresh moral and ethical guidelines to address the structural and systemic sinfulness of our time. The formulation of these guidelines is as much a political as a religious duty. Principle number 9. Because we are primarily beneficiaries of light and not of darkness, and our final destiny, both here and eternally, is that of enlightenment, we all need those sacred moments of ritualistic sacramental space, serving as heightened encounters with the sustaining mystery that enfolds us. Principle number 10. The concepts of beginning and end, along with the theological notions of resurrection and reincarnation, are invoked as dominant myths to help us humans make sense of our infinite destiny in an infinite universe. Principle number 11. Extinction and transformation, the evolutionary equivalents of Calvary and resurrection, are central coordinates of cosmic and planetary evolution. Their interplay at this historical moment are kairos, which means time or a moment in Greek, provides the primary locus for the praxis of the quantum theologian. And then finally, principle number 12, love is an interdependent life force, a spectrum of possibility, ranging from its ultimate divine grandeur to its particularity in subatomic interaction. It is the origin and goal of our search for meaning. Okay, everybody, that is our show. Thank you so much for listening. As I mentioned already, 949-354-2483 is our number. If you have any comments or questions about anything that I've said, please feel free to give me a call, leave me a voicemail. Patreon.com/Jason Stelman is where you can support my work, and my website is jasonstelman.com. Thanks, everybody. See you next week. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to Breadbox Media. Find more about us at breadboxmedia.com.